Hey, Morbidology listeners. Before we get on with today's episode, could I please request that you don't judge Morbidology on the early episodes? I'd recommend maybe listening from the newer ones backwards, because I honestly didn't find my feet in podcasting for quite some time. The quality of the early episodes, as well as the hosting, is not a true representation of Morbidology today, and I'm currently in the process of redoing them all. If you do listen to the earlier episodes, please don't judge the show on them, and maybe give a newer one a listen before deciding if the show is for you. Thank you so much for all of your support, and now on with the show. Welcome to Morbidology, the podcast. I'm your host, Emily G. Thompson, author of Unsolved Child Murders and co-author of Unsolved Murders, True Crime Cases Uncovered. For a number of serial killers, sometimes the act of murder just isn't enough to satisfy them. Some taunt the police in letters, some call family members to tease them, some take to the media to stir up emotions. Such cat and mouse messages often satisfy the killer's desperate ego and heighten their sense of control over the world. They want recognition and attention for their crimes, but sometimes these messages can be spurred by a sense of guilt, whether conscious or not. Between 1980 and 1982, a serial killer was terrorizing Minneapolis residents. He became known as the weepy-voiced killer due to the emotional phone calls he would make to police following his murders, begging them to catch him. It was New Year's Eve of 1980 when the weepy-voiced killer made his very first attack. 20-year-old Karen Potak was a University of Stevens Point student. She had been ringing in the new year with four family members in St. Paul. As it was approaching 1 a.m, Potak got into an argument with one of her sisters. Afterwards, she said that she was going to the bathroom but actually sneaked out of the nightclub. Feeling upset about the earlier argument, Potak started to walk the short distance back to her home. As she strolled down the street near Pierce Butler Road and Syndicate Avenue in St. Paul, she was ambushed. She was bludgeoned across the head with a tire iron before being left for dead alongside some train tracks under the cold winter sky. After the attack, local police received a phone call at approximately 3 a.m. As the man's voice cracked with emotion, he directed police to the crime scene.
Yes, please, this is an emergency. Police and a squad to Pierce Butler Road, Muhlenberg Manufacturing Company, machine shop. Please, there's an ambulance too. There's a girl hurt there.
Can you tell me what happened to her?
Just hurry, she's laying on the ground in the back by the railroad tracks, by the edge here. Hurry.
What's the address?
I don't know.
Who are you? Hello?
When police and paramedics arrived at the scene, they were horrified by the brutality of the attack. The beating was so violent that it exposed Potak's brain. St. Paul Police Sergeant James Nichols described the scene, quote, "By her eye, there was a lot of tissue hanging out. Then I saw her forehead. There was actually a hole, not a cut, and fleshy tissue hanging out. Bone was exposed on her forehead and some was missing," end quote. Miraculously, Potak survived the attack, but she was left without her memory. Sadly, the next victim wouldn't be so lucky. On the 3rd of June 1981, a group of teenage boys stumbled across a gruesome scene in St. Paul. As they were walking through a wooded area north of Superior and Oneida Street near the Interstate 35E, they found the body of 18-year-old Kimberly Compton. Compton was a young graduate from Pepin High School, which was just across the Mississippi River in Minnesota. She was known as a sweet, quiet, and shy girl, and her friend said that she was somewhat of a loner. Quote, "She got along with people, but they just never understood her," end quote, said her friend Janice Brooding. She had taken a bus to St. Paul in search of a job. Compton had had a tumultuous life. She never knew her father, and she was raised by her grandparents. When her grandmother died, Compton took it extremely hard, as it eroded much of the family support she had. She lived with other relatives and foster families, and when she was around 14 years old, she was raped. After spending time in a group home, Compton went back to live with her grandfather, and things appeared to be on the upswing. Next, we will hear from Compton's aunt, Sherry Covert, and her cousin, Earl McDonough.
Kimberly grew up in Pepin, Wisconsin. It was a small town at the time of 800 people. Kimberly and I are about 6 years apart. She was more my sister. I was raised with her.
It was just the average life, you know? But it was a good life. Good family, good people.
She was beautiful, soft-hearted, kind.
Kimberly, she was just a bright and fun gal.
Before her dead body turned up in St. Paul, Compton had left her grandfather a note which read, quote, "The reason I'm leaving isn't because I'm ungrateful for your taking me in. It's because there isn't anything in Pepin for me, and it'll be easier getting a job in a bigger area. I'm taking the bus, so you won't have to worry about me," end quote. Compton had always dreamed of becoming a sociologist or an archaeologist. She hopped off the bus in St. Paul and put her luggage and shoulder bag in a locker, but she sadly didn't get very far before being attacked. Less than 4 hours later, Compton was found dead. She had been stabbed 61 times, mainly on the chest, with an ice pick. All of her vital organs had been punctured in the attack. She was also strangled with a shoelace. In her pocket, police found an identification card, but just to be sure, they called her cousin down to identify the body.
So he contacted me, and I was probably, 20 years old myself, a young kid. But I had to identify her face. Sure enough, it was Kimberly.
Beside the identification card in her pocket, police also found the key to the locker at the local bus station. When they opened the locker, they found Compton's bags containing her clothing and personal items. After her murder, police received another phone call, much similar to the phone call they received following the first attack.
Will you find me? I just stabbed somebody with an ice pick. I can't stop myself. I keep killing somebody.
Hello? Are you there?
Police were successful in tracing the phone call to a payphone at a bar across the street from the bus depot at 9th and St. Peter Street. When they arrived, however, nobody was there. 2 days after the discovery of Compton's body, the man called 911 once again.
Don't talk, just listen. I'm sorry what I did to Compton. I couldn't help it. Don't know why I had to stab her. I am so upset about it. I keep getting drunk every day and I can't believe it. It's just like a big dream. I can't think of being locked up. If I get locked up, I'll kill myself. I'd rather kill myself than get locked up. I'll try not to kill anybody else.
He called back a third time, and this time he insisted that police were exaggerating when they said that Compton had been stabbed a total of 61 times. Two of the phone calls were successfully traced, the one that came from the payphone near the bus station, and another which came from a payphone at Butler Square, a retail area in Minneapolis. Following the murder of Compton, a local cab driver told police that he had spotted Compton leaving the bus station with a man who he described as being around 5 feet 8 inches tall with curly dark hair. He said that the man looked like he may have been Puerto Rican. However, this description was countered with a strikingly different description of the suspect. Two employees of the Inn Hotel on 175 West 7th Street said they saw Compton with a white man who was around 50 years old. They said that he had a white t-shirt and a pot belly. Composite sketches of both men were drawn up and circulated in the media. When very few tips came in, investigators decided to release the three phone calls from the weepy-voiced killer in the hopes that somebody could identify the voice. When the phone calls were played back to Compton's family, the eerie voice chilled them to the bone.
When he said that he was stabbing her, I could actually feel it on myself, like it was being done to myself. And it always went through my head for a long, long time. I could hear her hollering, "Aunt Sherry, help me, Aunt Sherry, help me," and I could do nothing.
Another suspect was a man who lived in a tent in the wooded area where Compton's body was found. The man was quite peculiar, often howling like a wolf under the trees while sniffing paint. However, he was quickly ruled out. Several weeks later, another suspect came to light. Alan Lopez barricaded himself in his St. Paul home after beating his mother, father, and sister to death. After being apprehended, Lopez confessed to murdering Compton. However, an investigation uncovered that Lopez was sectioned in Aoka State Hospital at the time of the attack on Potak. While Lopez never mentioned Potak, police were convinced that the same man perpetrated both attacks due to the phone calls. However, it was then discovered that Lopez had been on a pass during the New Year's attack on Potak. Once again, he was considered a likely suspect. Homicide detective Earl Miles said that Lopez was a customer at a bar around 5 blocks from the bus station and that he had a history of violence and a strong hatred of women. While Lopez was still being investigated as the weepy-voiced killer, he committed suicide in his cell in the State Security Hospital at St. Peter. Investigators were almost certain that they had the right guy. However, they soon uncovered that Lopez was in the Ramsey County Detention Center when Compton was murdered. Back to square one. On the 21st of July, 1982, 33-year-old Kathleen Greening from St. Paul was scheduled to go on a vacation to Mackinac Island with her best friend, Carol Kellogg. Greening and Kellogg had been best friends since 1971, when they both taught in Hudson. The women often dined together, shopped together, and played golf together, and in 1981, they vacationed together in Mexico. On the morning they were scheduled to leave for their vacation, Greening had planned to drive to Kellogg's home for breakfast before the duo departed for the airport. When Greening didn't show up, Kellogg became concerned and drove over to her home. When nobody answered her knocks at the front door, she let herself in as the door was unlocked. She called out for Greening, but there was no reply, so she started to search the home, room to room. She got to the bathroom and noticed that the light was on and the door was partially closed. Kellogg pushed open the door and discovered exactly why her best friend wasn't replying when she called her name. She was dead. Greening's naked body was face up in the water with her head under the tap and her knees bent towards the front of the tub. Kellogg noticed that the water level in the bath was unusually high and that there was no soap, towel, or clean clothing to indicate that Greening had planned on bathing. Initially, police ruled her death as an accident, despite the fact that adults very rarely drown in the bathtub by accident unless they suffer from a seizure or hit their head on something. However, there were no other injuries, internal or external, on Greening's body. 4 years later, Ramsey County Medical Examiner Michael McGee determined that it was a homicide and not an accident. As a matter of fact, a number of people pointed their finger at Greening's estranged husband, David. At the time of her murder, the couple were going through a bitter divorce. It wouldn't be until years later that her death would also be attributed to the weepy-voiced killer. The fourth victim would be 40-year-old nurse from the Minneapolis side of the river, Barbara Simons. On the 5th of August, 1982, Simons had been at the Hexagon Bar. Simons was a regular at the bar, which was situated in the same neighborhood where she lived. It was here that Simons met her killer when she offered him a cigarette. Simons told a waitress that the man was going to give her a lift home. According to the waitress, Simons had joked, quote, "I hope this guy isn't an animal. All I need is a ride home. I have work in the morning," end quote. Simons was found dead the following morning by a newspaper carrier who was walking along the Mississippi River near 29th Street. She had been beaten and then stabbed 106 times. Much like Compton, all of her internal organs had been punctured by the brutal killer. She was identified via her fingerprints. Detective Donald Brown was assigned to the case.
The perpetrator evidently tried to dispose of the body by throwing her down the embankment towards the river, but the underbrush was so thick that it held up the body.
Simon's sister informed police that she had been in the Hexagon Bar on the night of her murder. Therefore, the bar was the first point of investigation for police. Dennis Phillips, a bartender at Hexagon Bar, told police that the man who gave Simons a lift that night was a regular at the bar, but that he didn't know his name. He also said that the man was a loner and that he had cold eyes. Once again, the killer called police.
Fire emergency.
Please don't talk, just listen. I'm sorry I killed that girl. I stabbed her 40 times. Kimberly Compton was the first one over safe. Oh, I don't know what you're mad at me. I'm sick. I'm going to kill myself, I think.
Where are you?
I'm just going to... If somebody dies with a red shirt on, it's me. I killed both of you. I'm sorry. I'll never make it to
heaven. Calm down.
Whoever the man was, he was practically begging to be caught. Due to the phone calls, it was evident that the murders were committed by the same perpetrator. Coincidentally, Potak, Compton, and Simons were all wearing red when they were attacked, and this led some to speculate that the killer had specifically targeted them due to their clothing.
But there was talk about this guy is targeting women who are wearing red. People, especially women who heard those recordings, would be frightened by what they heard.
Obviously, he wasn't going to kill every woman in red he saw, but police were sure he was waiting for the right opportunity to isolate a woman and kill again, and they had to find him before that happened.
Police released the phone calls to the public once again and implemented a tip line so that if anybody recognized the voice, they could call in with a tip.
In both cases, a man with a troubled voice called police dispatchers and confessed to the killing.
They kept repeating the phone calls over the media.
The police have established a special line.
This line is specifically for this investigation and will be manned by a police officer.
Most people that were calling into the tip phone line were saying something like it sounded like so and so. From an evidentiary perspective, unless someone had some really good information, it wasn't going to identify the suspect.
The first person that police wanted to speak to in relation to the murder was the man that Simons had met at the bar, the man who had supposedly given her a lift home. Maybe he knew something about her murder. Maybe he was the murderer. Witnesses were able to provide police with a description of the man. He was described as being around 40 years old, 6 feet tall, and 185 pounds. The witnesses said that he had a dark complexion and receding black hair. A number of people working in the Hexagon Bar that evening went down to police headquarters to sift through the mugshots of around 160 local felons to see if they could identify the man at the bar with Compton. One waitress picked out 37-year-old Paul Michael Stefani as the man who had left the Hexagon Bar that evening with Simons.
We learned that Stefani had been jailed for an aggravated assault on another woman. He was ordered by the judge to have psychological evaluation.
He was married once with a daughter, but abandoned his family. His relationship problems means that he might have some issues with women.
Stefani grew up in an exceptionally religious family in Austin, Minnesota, and moved to St. Paul in the 60s, where he worked as a hospital janitor and a shipping clerk. He unloaded trucks at a steel mill and a tool company. In his place of employment, Stefani was known as a nice guy, often offering to walk women to their cars following their shift because there was an unidentified serial killer targeting women. Stefani couldn't hold down a job. He later blamed this on the epilepsy he had suffered as a young boy. He had also been married at one point and had a young daughter. However, one day, he just decided to up and abandon his family. As investigators look further into Stefani's background, they discover that years earlier, he had lost a job at the Malberg Manufacturing Company, right beside where Potak was attacked. After Stefani was tentatively identified as the potential weepy-voiced killer, they placed him under surveillance.
He drove down to Interstate 94 and went westbound towards Minneapolis. During that time, the surveillance team lost sight of him.
After losing sight of Stefani, he attacked his final victim. 19-year-old Denise Williams from Minneapolis was working as a sex worker in Minneapolis's red light district. She was approached by Stefani on Hennepin and 6th Street, and he asked her for her services.
I was walking around looking for somebody that was looking for me.
The duo arranged a price, and Williams hopped into Stefani's car and headed to his apartment.
And we went to his apartment, and he was real quick, like 2 seconds. So I was like, dang, he's gonna wanna do something else again. But he was like, no, it's cool.
Stefani offered to drive Williams back to the street corner she was working. However, en route, he turned down a dead-end road.
The road was like, there was no street lights. It started getting dark now, okay? And he's like, this is a shortcut. And I was like, oh yeah, I was like, this man is up to something, because this is not a shortcut.
Williams was a street smart woman. She knew that something was going wrong and she was potentially in extreme danger.
So I'm like, dang, I ain't got no weapon or nothing. But then I look down on the floor of his car and there's a bottle, a tab bottle. So I'm like, well, if he tries to do anything to me, I'm just gonna hit him with this bottle and run.
Before she even had a chance to react, Stefani lunged at her with a screwdriver, stabbing her a total of 15 times. Williams spotted a glass bottle that was sitting on the footwell of the passenger seat. She grabbed it and smashed it over Stefani's face.
I really was like, well, if I gotta die for nothing, you're gonna die for nothing.
She managed to open the passenger door and tumble out with Stefani still on top of her, still stabbing her indiscriminately. Doug Panning, a local man who lived nearby, was fast asleep with the window open when he heard all of the commotion. Initially, he thought it was drunk students, but when he looked out of his window, he saw Stefani on top of Williams and rushed to offer assistance.
There was this guy on top of this gal, and he was just whacking away, man. Just big, big swooping booms, and you could hear the screwdriver hitting the bones, the crack, and the, you know, crunching. And it was a pretty scary sight because he was cut up pretty bad himself. And he had blood running all down his shirt, and he's taking whacks at me.
When Panning ran to his house to retrieve a gun, Stefani jumped in his car and sped away from the crime scene. Panning called 911, and Williams was transported to ER, where she made a full recovery. When Stefani arrived back at his apartment, he noticed that the wounds he had sustained were quite severe. He decided to seek out medical treatment and called emergency operators.
Where?
1505 Westminster.
1505?
Yes.
Westminster, what's the problem?
I'm all cut up. I got beat up.
What's your apartment number?
208, I'm bleeding.
208, where are you bleeding from?
From my arm, my face, my head.
Following the phone call, the operator noticed that the caller had oral similarities to the so-called weepy-voiced killer phone calls. In hospital, both Williams and Panning identified a photograph of Stefani as the man yielding the screwdriver. By this point, Stefani was in the Ramsey County Medical Center being treated for his injuries. Police arrived at the hospital and began questioning him in relation to the attacks. They executed a search warrant of his apartment where they discovered a bloody screwdriver and bloody clothing. On the 24th of August 1982, Paul Michael Stefani was formally charged with the attempted murder of Williams and first-degree murder in the case of Barbara Simons. Public defender Jim Grieger said that the first-degree murder indictment should be dismissed because it was based solely on voice prints from the 911 calls that he claimed may not be reliable. Dr. Harry Holan, a University of Florida professor of linguistics, speech, and criminal justice, developed a computerized method of comparing voices, and according to him, the analysis proved that Stefani had made the weepy-voiced killer phone calls. Holan had used a machine that measures specific features of speech signals and converts them into numerical values that can be compared by a computer with the values reached on other voices. He compared the voice recording of the phone call to a voice recording of Stefani, taken following his arrest.
I remember telling him when he said, I went home and took a shower, and then I called, you go towards the door,
voice prints were used during grand jury testimony to link Stefani to the weepy-voiced killer. Grieger argued that the computer analysis of voices is not reliable. Prosecuting attorney John Ryan refuted Krieger's arguments and stated that the grand jury had sufficient evidence to support the indictment with or without the voice print analysis. The voice print analysis actually became the center of a legal contest over whether the analysis should be admissible as evidence. District Judge Robert Bowen ruled them inadmissible due to the fact that such tests and results were not sufficiently reliable. However, he did rule that the phone calls could be played in trial. During Stefani's February 1985 trial, his defense lawyer Bruce Hartigan said in his opening statement that when Stefani is stressed, he sounds exactly like the person who made the phone calls, but contended that the phone calls hadn't come from him. Central to the prosecution's case were the taped phone calls. District Judge Robert Bowen allowed the jurors to listen to the phone calls to make up their own mind whether or not they were placed by Stefani. Furthermore, Stefani's ex-wife, sister, and a former roommate all testified that the phone calls certainly did come from Stefani.
The defendant's sister testified. She listened to the tapes in court in front of the jury, put her head down, cried. So that's Paul. That's my brother.
Key testimony in the trial came from two waitresses who were working at the Hexagon Bar the night Simons was murdered. Both waitresses saw Simons leave the bar that night with Stefani. Stefani did not take the stand, but three times during the trial, he objected to statements about what he told police about the beating of Potak. When Police Sergeant John Brown was testifying, Stefani stood up and accused him of lying. After a six-week trial, Stefani was found guilty of the murder of Barbara Simons and was sentenced to 40 years. Hennepin County District Judge Robert Bowen said that he was imposing a longer sentence than recommended due to the sheer brutality of the crime. Simons had been stabbed over 100 times with a screwdriver. As he was being sentenced, Stefani interrupted the judge to say, quote, "I didn't know what I was doing," end quote. He was also sentenced to an additional 18 years for the assault on Denise Williams. Ramsey County prosecutors announced that they would not be pursuing charges in the other weepy-voiced killer cases. According to Lieutenant Joe Corcoran, they just didn't have enough physical evidence to warrant a trial.
I think that what they did was took Kim's case and put it on the back burner and figured, well, nobody's going to do nothing about this anyhow. Her family ain't going to come around and do anything. And I just got to the point to where nothing was being done that I thought this is it.
In 1997, Stefani confessed to three murders after being diagnosed with cancer and finding out that he had a year to live. Stefani referred to himself as a devout Roman Catholic who communicated with God. Quote, "I'd rather go to the grave knowing this is all taken care of and off my chest. To this day, I can't believe it. I wake up in the morning thinking and hoping I'm dreaming all of this, but then I say, no, Paul, you're still in jail. I don't know what to do except say I wish I could turn back the clock," end quote. First of all, Stefani confessed to the murder of Kim Compton to Sergeant Bob Paskett of the St. Paul Police Department.
This gal was sitting like one or two seats away from him, and she had just gotten in town, and he strikes up a conversation with her and learns that she had just gotten off the bus.
And then that's when she started telling me where she was from in Wisconsin and all that. And I says, well, say, why don't you, I'm not even thinking about her right now. I says, hey, why don't you let me show you around town?
He said she had just stepped off a bus in St. Paul and walked over the road to Mickey's Diner, where Stefani was having a coffee. Stefani told the officer that he offered to drive Compton around the town and show her the sights. He said he initially intended on showing her the Delta Queen and having a picnic, but in 15 minutes, she was dead.
I said, yeah, I want to show you something. There's really a nice view over here. You see the nice river. I think I mentioned somebody you can probably have something to tell your parents about then.
So he uses the pretense of the view. They get out of the car, and he says he parks the car in the bushes.
As I walked out of the car, I carried my knife with me. I had every intention to hurt him. I lay down in the grass, and I remember opening up a bra and just feeling the stuff, and they just start stabbing.
Unfortunately, I think what we learned is that there's really no way to combat him. There was no way to protect his his victims out there. I mean, he would find one. He would have kept on killing had he not been caught. I don't know exactly what turned him on, but the only way he were going to turn him off was put him behind bars.
Compton's family had suspected for a number of years that Stefani had killed her, and now with the confession, they finally had some closure.
I called everybody and said he has finally confessed to murdering Kim. And I got to actually say this, I truly forgive him because he was crazy. But the pain is always going to be in my heart.
Stefani also confessed to the murders of Barbara Simons and Kathleen Greening. While he was found guilty of the murder of Simons, he had never actually confessed, and he had always denied any involvement. When he confessed to the murder of Greening, it came as quite a shock because he had never even been considered a suspect in her death due to the fact that he never made a phone call to police following the murder. As mentioned earlier, Greening's estranged husband had always been the main suspect in the murder. In 1991, Governor Arnie Carlston called for a secret investigation into Greening's murder. She lambasted Ramsey County Attorney Tom Foley, who had handled the case at the time. Carol Kellogg, Greening's friend who had found the body, also chimed in and criticized Foley for not charging Greening's estranged husband with the murder. The case mushroomed into a political dispute when it was charged that Carlston was overstepping his legal powers by ordering the investigation. When Stefani confessed to Greening's murder, investigators said that he was able to provide details about the crime and the crime scene that only the killer would have known. He claimed that he and Greening had dated and had consensual sex on the night of her murder. He said that the two of them took a bath together, during which he decided he would kill her.
You say that you both got into the tub?
Yes.
And you're positive about that?
Yes. Because, I mean, I remember when I pushed her head underwater, I could see her face.
Did you push her in by her, push her head down, or did you push her in the chest area to, under the water?
I held her shoulders down.
You held her shoulders down? Both hands then?
The claim that they had sex that evening was something that Kellogg said she wasn't convinced by. Quote, "That is totally outrageous. That raises a lot of suspicion for me," end quote, she said. However, investigators found a piece of evidence which could at least connect Stefani to Greening. In Greening's home, they found an address book with Stefani's name and phone number. In addition to confessing the murders, Stefani also confessed to his attack on Potak.
Do you remember where you hit her with the tire iron pump?
I did.
I mean, did you hit her one time, two times?
Mostly about 30 times, but I mean, a good 20 times I think I know.
Were you swinging it this way, or did you poke her with it, or do you
I don't think I poked her, no. I remember it hitting her mainly on the forehead, on the cheek, and the jaw, the mouth, and the top of the head. I think it was only about 10 times, but then I know she must really be hurting in that, you know, the steel bar like that.
Is he insane? No. Is he different than most people that you see? Yes. And as he relived these incidents, he dropped back into the same voice and same person that he was 20-some years ago.
I was even hurt when I went back to the car. There, there's going like this. I mean, and that's when I made me want to go to the phone. I mean, I really wanted to help her. My mind started clearing up. What are you doing? You had a chance to make another friend. I kept yelling at myself. You like to make friends.
On the 11th of June, 1998, Stefani died in the infirmary of the Oak Heights Maximum Security Prison, closing the final chapter in the tragedy and eerie saga of the weepy-voiced killer.
I couldn't help it.
It's hard to understand how people can be that evil, but it's like, yep, they can. The capacity for man to do horrible, evil things is just boundless.
Well guys, that is it for this episode of Morbidology. As always, thank you so much for listening. I'd like to give a big massive thank you to our new Patreons, Emma, The Murder in My Family, Ishiar, Darius, and Haley. I'm really sorry if I pronounced any of those names wrong. Morbidology is a one-woman podcast, so the support really does go a long way in helping me cover the costs of hosting, producing, researching, and all that important stuff that goes into running a website and podcast. If you're interested in ad-free episodes and early release episodes and articles, make sure you check us out on Patreon. I'd also like to give a big thank you to everybody that has taken the time to leave a kind review on iTunes and everybody that has simply listened to an episode, shared, commented. I really do appreciate all of the support. Also, make sure you visit us at morbidology.com for more information about this episode and to read our true crime articles. Until next time, take care of yourselves and have an amazing week.
Case Remains is a true crime podcast dedicated to missing persons and unsolved mysteries. Join me, Beth, every 2 weeks as we delve into some of the lesser known unsolved cases from around the world. Until next time, stay safe.
The Unseen Podcast, we look at cases of missing people, unresolved investigations, and above all, we focus on UK true crime. So if you want to listen to UK cases and care about little-known stories that might have been forgotten about, then we are the podcast for you. Join me, Caprice, every Sunday as we delve into these stories. You can find the Unseen Podcast anywhere you are currently listening, and I hope you can join me in discussing forgotten and unresolved cases.